Hop. You are listening to the PHTLS podcast. My name is Dr. Jeffrey Guy. I'm an associate professor of surgery and director of the Burn Center at the Vanderbilt University School of Medicine. Also, I serve as the associate editor and medical director of PHTLS. For years, PHTLS has been teaching the concept of selective spinal mobilization. And we have presented for years the literature to suggest that not in every scenario does spinal mobilization help the patient. And we've actually presented data, particularly data out of Israel, to show that in cases of penetrating injury to the spine, that immobilization actually will result in perhaps harm to the patient as well as harm to the provider who's providing care under fire. This topic has resurfaced recently in a January 2010 Journal of Trauma by an article published by Elliot Hott of Johns Hopkins University. He is an assistant professor there, and he and his co-authors recently published an article that looked at immobilizing the spines of shooting and stabbing victims before they were taking to the hospital. What was the impact of this? And the idea of immobilizing people of penetrating trauma is really a standard not only in Maryland but in various other parts of the country. But based on Dr. Hott's study, he has shown that this almost doubles the risk of death compared to transporting patients to trauma center without immobilization of the spines because of the time-consuming nature of this. Now, Hott and his co-authors are very cautious to point out that spinal mobilization has been shown to be well worth the time and effective in saving lives as well as disability of patients who have sustained blunt trauma in the form of car accidents or similar events. Dr. Hott, a trauma surgeon at Johns Hopkins, says the patients who are very, very severely injured from their penetrating trauma are going to die no matter what you do. But if someone is stabbed in the lung or shot in the liver, what we do for them and how fast we do it makes a huge difference. The time difference is getting them to the hospital for treatment may make a difference between life and death. Hunt and his colleagues look at the records of more than 45,000 patients with penetrating trauma, including the National Trauma Data Bank from the years 2001 to 2004. They calculated the chance of benefiting from spine mobilization in those cases was 1 in 1,000, while 15 additional people potentially died for every 1,000 shooting or stabbing victims immobilized before being taken to the hospital. Pre-hospital providers who immobilize gunshot wound or stab wound victims do not intend to do harm, but it does emphasize that the cervical collar actually may, because it can certainly conceal an injury to the trachea or making an inserting an endotracheal tube more difficult. And this really gets us to reevaluate pre-hospital protocols, such as the need for universal IV fluids, as well as also been called into question in some recent studies. This gives me an opportunity to go back and talk about some of the issues of spinal mobilization as outlined in pre-hospital trauma life support. Now, penetrating injury represents a special consideration regarding the potential for spine trauma. In general, if a patient did not sustain a definitive neurological injury at the moment the trauma occurred, there is little concern for spine injury. This is because of the mechanisms of injury and the kinematics associated with the force involved. Penetrating objects generally do not produce unstable spine fractures, as does blunt force injury, because a penetrating trauma produces minimal risk of unstable ligamentous or bony injury. A penetrating object causes injury along the path of penetration. If the object did not directly injure the spinal cord as it penetrated, the patient is unlikely to develop a spinal cord injury. Numerous studies have shown that unstable spine injuries rarely occur from penetrating trauma to the head, neck, or torso. And this is what we've outlined in the 6th edition of the Pre-Hospital Trauma Life Support Manual. Certainly, this was the finding in this recent article in the Journal of Trauma here, January of 2010, but the other sources are Chong and colleagues in Journal of Trauma of 1998, Copps and colleagues in Journal of Trauma 1998, Lenoy and colleagues in Journal of Trauma of 2000, Barcana and colleagues in Injury in the year 2003, Cornwall and colleagues, Archives of Surgery in 2001, as well as outlined the American College of Surgeons Committee on Trauma, Advanced Trauma Life Support Manual in the 7th edition, which was published in 2004. So the idea of not immobilizing an injury, a penetrating injury, is not a new concept, though every time we seem to present it, people are really kind of taken back by it. But now we have evidence that it actually will increase the likelihood of death from a penetrating injury. Therefore, penetrating injuries are not indications for spinal mobilization unless a neurological deficit is identified. In general, the other injuries created by the penetrating trauma require a higher priority in management of those of the spine. So this gets into the indications for spinal mobilization, what we call selective immobilization. And if you have a PHTLS manual, the 6th edition, it's figure 912 on page 235. The mechanisms of injury can be used as an aid to determine indications for spinal mobilization. The key point always is that a complete physical assessment coupled with good clinical judgment will guide decision making, and if in doubt, immobilize. Now, here's where we get where PHTLS is feathering in with this current research, is that patients with penetrating injury, gunshot wound or stab wounds to the head, neck, or torso should be considered having a concerning mechanism of injury when they're complaining of neurological symptoms or display such findings as numbness, tingling, or loss of motor sensory function, or actual loss of consciousness. However, if a patient with a penetrating injury has no neurological complaints, secondary mechanism of injury, or findings, the spine does not need to be immobilized, although the backboard may still be used for lifting and transport purposes. So now we're going to review the actual indications for spinal mobilization. And again, this is from the PHTLS manual. This is page 234 of the 6th edition. Number one is altered level of consciousness. Now, with a GCS, or Glasgow's Coma Scale, of less than 15, any factor that alters the patient's perception of pain will potentially hinder the responder's assessment for injury. Now, this includes the following: traumatic brain injury, altered mental status other than traumatic brain injury, for example, patients with psychiatric illness, Alzheimer's, or under the influence of intoxicants, may have impaired pain perception. Acute stress reactions may cause pain masking. Number two would be spinal pain or tenderness. This includes pain or pain on movement, point tenderness and deformity, and guarding of the spinal areas. Number three would be neurological deficit or complaint, and this includes bilateral paralysis, partial paralysis, paresis, numbness, prickling or tingling, as well as neurological spinal shock below the level of the injury. Now, in males, a persistent erection of the penis, also known as priapism, may be an additional indication for spinal cord injury. Anatomic deformity of the spine is number four. This includes any deformity noted on physical examination of the patient. Now, however, the absence of these signs does not rule out a bony spinal injury. When a patient has a concerning mechanism of injury in the absence of the conditions just listed, the reliability of the patient must be assessed. A reliable patient is calm, cooperative, and sober. An unreliable patient may exhibit any of the following. Number one, intoxication. Patients who are under the influence of drugs or alcohol are immobilized and managed as if they had spinal injury until they are calm, cooperative, and sober. Distracting painful injuries. Injuries that are severely painful may prevent the patient from giving a reliable response during the assessment. Examples would include fractured femur or a large burn. The third would be communication barriers. Communication problems include language barriers, deafness, very young patients, or patients who for any reason cannot communicate effectively. The patient should be continually rechecked for reliability at all phases of an assessment. If at any time the patient exhibits these signs or symptoms, it should be assumed that the patient has a spinal injury and full immobilization management techniques should be implemented. In many situations, the mechanism of injury is not indicative of a neck injury, such as falling on an outstretched hand or producing a Colles fracture. In these patients, in the presence of a normal examination and proper assessment, spinal immobilization is not indicated. Now, again, this is a review of the PHTLS pre-hospital indications for what we call selective immobilization. And the words we've chosen here are very careful in that we're not talking about pre-hospital clearance. We have previously presented information that shows that a person who has penetrating injuries from a gunshot wound or a stab wound received no benefit from pre-hospital spinal mobilization. And now when we present this new information presented in the January 2010 Journal of Trauma, we are also capable of showing that immobilization of people who have penetrating injuries actually increases their mortality rate. You're listening to the Pre-Hospital Trauma Life Support Podcast. My name is Jeffrey Guy. Thanks for listening.